Good morning. It's time for the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me?
Good morning, I'm Jane Marie Schaefer.
Good morning, I'm Dan Glasser.
And we are two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm, and this is the Herzog Law Firm Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, where we answer your questions about estate planning, wills, trusts, Medicaid, guardianship, and real estate, as we have Dan on today. Dan is our real estate attorney, and we would be happy to take your calls. The call-in number here is 518-476-5900, 518-476-5900. So how is everyone this morning?
I'm really good. I can't believe that we are almost to the end of 2021.
I know. I can't believe it. So we're getting into the Christmas season, right, after Thanksgiving. And
yes.
I have a question for you. How many children do you have, Dan?
I have six.
So my question is, with six children, well, how many of them still believe in Santa Claus?
We'd like to think they all do.
Okay.
I'm not sure. The oldest are going to be 16 in a few weeks, and mm-hmm. they haven't told us that they don't, so mm-hmm. we just go that they still believe.
Well, they're doing that for the younger ones, I would believe, right?
Possibly, and also their parents, maybe.
Oh, for you guys, right?
Yeah.
So when my kids were young, I used to have my presents delivered to the office so that I could hide them from the kids. And then I would bring them home Christmas Eve. I was wondering what you do with that many children. Where do you hide your presents?
We have a room in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
I call it the junk room. It's our storage room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we hide things. Or sometimes, depending on the size of the gift, it'll go in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids know that they're not supposed to go in there because the elves are watching them.
That's cool. I wonder if that works, but that's cool.
Yeah.
So we're coming up to the Christmas season. So I read this little article this week. And for those of you who are grandparents out there, this was, what are the best Christmas TV specials to watch with your grandkids? And they have, you know, the top five. Some of these I certainly remember from when I was a kid. So any guesses as to what number one is?
Christmas Story?
No, that would be a good one, though. So the number one is a classic. It's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yes, okay.
Right, how could we forget that one, right? And this is really great, you know, for grandparents, for some bonding time with your grandkids. You know, these specials are just classics. They're really great. Number two is A Charlie Brown Christmas.
Okay.
That is another great one, in my opinion. Number three is How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
That's a good one.
And I think that's probably one of my favorites to watch. Let's see. The next one, and these are really all like our childhood ones. Well, maybe Ben and my childhood.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Dan, you're a little bit younger there, so maybe not.
Yeah.
It's funny, actually, they have to be next to some of these that they were put out. Ben, you have any idea when Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer was put out?
1964-65.
Are you reading the same article as me?
I am not. I just know that I was really, really young when it first came out. But I was alive, so.
Yes, it was 1964, and then the Charlie Brown Christmas was 1965. So you're kind of right on the map there.
Yeah, those are two of my favorites. So I'm surprised you haven't mentioned Frosty yet.
That was number four.
Thank you.
And that was out in 1969. And the last one they have on this list is The Year Without a Santa Claus. I didn't expect that one to be on the list, but that's what it is. So these are just some good things to watch, get in the Christmas spirit with your family. You know, grandparents may not be going out to shop in person, but they certainly can shop online or have their grandkids show them how to shop online.
Right. Amazon.com.
That's right. Now, this other article I read this week made me really, really happy. So, are either of you coffee drinkers?
No.
Yes, I am. Drinking it now.
Good. About how many cups do you say you drink a day?
I mean, are we defining cup as like a standard 6 ounce?
Oh, no. My mug is probably like 3 cups, but I count that as one. Oh. So.
I would say a large mug, travel mug.
I too drink about 2 mugs a day. So there's good news for that. This was a study that was done of coffee drinkers, and they said that drinking higher amounts of coffee may make you less likely to develop Alzheimer's disease, which is really amazing. So they found that higher coffee intake could, lead to a slower decline of, loss of memory. Also, it's linked to the slowing of the accumulation of the amyloid protein in the brain. That's something that causes Alzheimer's disease. They even found that, and that's why I was asking you how many cups, you drink, because they said, well, 1 cup helps, but 2 cups helps even more.
Okay. So
that's right. They saw a big increase in, lowering cognitive decline by 2 cups of coffee per day. So I think that is really cool. They said more studies are needed to determine exactly what it is in coffee that helps prevent Alzheimer's disease, but I'm going to keep drinking my coffee every day.
Same.
Ben, do we make you a coffee convert? I don't think we made him a coffee convert. Maybe he's sticking to tea.
Oh. Yeah, I wonder what happens when you drink 8 cups a day.
Jay Marie, Dan, we do have a caller. We have Gordon from Tassawassa Lake.
Okay. Good morning, Gordon. How are you?
Hey, good morning. I was trying to reach you last week, and you had a caller at the end that went to the end of the show, so I thought I'd try this week a little earlier.
That's great.
I am a recent federal retiree last spring, and 63 years old, and I'm wondering, I hear a lot about Medicare, and I've got another year of breathing space before I have to fully immerse myself in that, but I'm thinking, with my benefits, they're very good as far as health goes. It went up a little bit as a retiree versus active service, but I'm still paying in total about $200 a month for full medical, dental, and vision, and with no co-pays and almost nothing out of pocket. So that's pretty good, and I don't know how Medicare can enter into that equation. Does it, or am I missing something?
Well, I mean, I think you can continue to keep that health insurance until you turn age 65 when you are eligible for Medicare. It sounds like your health insurance is really great, and the fact that it has dental and vision is also really great, because that's not covered by Medicare. And, you know, the premium, it sounds like it's a really great deal also. So then when you become eligible for Medicare, and you know, should probably confirm all this with a health care counselor, there are Medicare counselors that you can talk to. They're called HICAP counselors. To see, you know, when you reach that age, then what the comparison is, you know, if you keep your health insurance and you know, don't take Medicare, or maybe you can take Medicare and, you know, get a supplement plan from your pension. But for right now, I think I would stick with your plan.
Well, my question is that I'm not aware of any change that happens to my federal benefits at age 65. That's something I'm missing, but does something happen at 65 to my benefits that I currently have that I'm forced to look at Medicare?
At 65, and this is where you should talk to a HICAP counselor, because I know that federal employees are exempt from certain requirements, you know, so normally you would be required to take Medicare, but maybe because you're a federal employee, you don't have to. So normally that would be the age where you'd have to take Medicare, and you would need that for your coverage. Sometimes if you don't take Medicare at the age you're supposed to, you could be assessed a penalty later on.
So
that's why I would talk to a counselor, because I would want to make sure you're not incurring any kind of penalty by not taking Medicare when you're able to.
Yeah. But you haven't heard of any such scenario, have you?
I'm not, as I said, I don't know all the rules, for a federal employee, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would either check with one of these HICAP counselors, or I would check with your, you know, retirement department to see if they can give you some information.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your help. I appreciate it.
Okay. Sure. You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
So that's great that people are calling in early. You don't want to, wait to the last minute and not get your questions in. So please give us a call at 518-476-5905. And that kind of brings me to another article I was going to mention.
Jay Marie.
Okay.
The phone number to get in is 518-476-5900, 5900. No, just making sure, because if they try to get in at that number, it'll be busy. So 518-476-5900.
I know, that's the number I call in. And I have it on a sticky note in front of me. That's my mistake there. All right. So talking about Medicare and talking about Social Security, there's really good news this year. So Social Security came out with the amount of their COLA increases for 2022. And for those of you who get Social Security, you should know that every year you get a cost of living adjustment. In the past, it hasn't been that generous, or there was even one year recently where there was no increase. But this year, the cost of living adjustment is going to be 5.9%. And they said that's the largest increase in four decades. So what does that mean? That means the average retirement benefit will increase about $92 per month. So that is very cold, because many, many people rely on Social Security. And in fact, they said Social Security is the largest source of retirement for most Americans and provides nearly all income for one in four seniors. So that is kind of crazy there. Now, your Social Security is going up, but there you're going to have to offset that. There's an increase also in the Medicare premium. So the Medicare premium for 2022 is going to be $170.10. So $170.10. So that's an increase of about $21 from last year. So you have to offset your increase in the Social Security by the more that you're paying for Medicare. But that made me think of, if that gentleman is paying about $200 a month for his insurance, that's similar to what he would be paying for Medicare. So that's why he should talk to a counselor and see which would be the better program for him. All right, so this week, Dan, as you know, is our real estate attorney, and he does all of our real estate closings. And besides just doing closings for people who are buying new homes, you also do closings for a lot of our clients that have trusts and are selling their homes out of trust. So there's always some questions that come up when there's a trust involved with a real estate closing. It's a little bit more, detailed than usual. So what are some of the questions that you've received about trusts and real estate, Dan?
So I had a closing recently with a trustee selling a property, and right when we got into the parking lot, she was holding, a big fat check and said, "Oh, fantastic. Let me just go to my bank and deposit this into my checking account." I said, "Pump the brakes. It needs to go into an account that is under the name of the trust." And she said, "What?"
I was just going to say, I'm glad you told her that because, you're the real estate attorney, but now you've learned a lot from us about doing trust.
Right. So could you tell our wonderful audience what the for that is?
Sure. So that is, that would have been a mistake had she went and put that in her own account. And the reason for that is having your house in a trust is a way to protect that house from the cost of long-term care and from Medicaid. So when you sell the house and the money that you get, you want to keep that protected as well. So if you put that back in your own bank account, now it's your money again and you're losing that protection that you've worked so hard to build up. So what you need to do is to take that check and you need to have your trustees open up a trust bank account and put that money into a trust bank account. And if it goes directly into a trust bank account, that money is going to stay protected. So that's really important to do that. And that is a mistake that people sometimes make if they don't really understand how the trust works or they don't ask the question, right?
So someone asked me a question the other day. I'm thinking about getting a will done. It's call me young family, husband, wife, two kids. They had heard or read something about trusts, and they said, "What's the difference?" So could you go into, if someone says, "I want a will," would it be them to get a trust, and what factors might impact that decision?
Yeah, sure. So I imagine this was a younger couple, right? So, so for a younger couple that's trying to get estate planning done, we start off with a will, definitely. And, most younger couples think of doing a will when they have children, because they want to have a guardian for their children, right? And that can be done in a will. You can nominate who you want to be the guardian. You can also think about how you would want your children to be taken care of, how you would want them to receive money. We often say that a child probably isn't mature enough at 18 to get a large sum of money. So you can set up a trust for a child. And you can have the guardian be the trustee and manage the money until the child is older. So those are some of the big concerns that a younger family would have, and that I would definitely recommend that they have a will. Now, to also explain to them what a trust is so they know the difference, a trust is a document that you set up that you put all of your assets into the name of a trust while you're still alive. It's managed by a trustee. And the reason you would do that, there's really two main reasons you would set up a trust. And the first one is to protect your assets right, in case you need a nursing home. So that's not going to be typical for the younger family, right? So they're not going to think about doing that until they're, you know, around 65, around the time they retire. That would be the time to think about doing that trust to protect their assets. There is another reason to do a trust, though, that applies to anyone, and that's to avoid probate. So probate is the process of when you have a will. That will have to be probated. That means you have to file it with the court and have an executor appointed before anything, any money can be accessed or anything can be transferred after your death. So having to go to court and probate the will, it takes some time, and it takes, you know, it costs money. There's delays there. So for those different reasons, some people try to avoid the probate process by setting up a will instead. I mean, setting up a trust instead. And this trust is a revocable trust. The trust for protecting the assets is an irrevocable trust. So the revocable trust is, you know, if you're younger, that's something you could consider doing. With a revocable trust, you're in charge of the trust. So, you know, you and your spouse can manage the trust. You control it. You put money in and out of the trust. You can change the beneficiaries. And that benefits your heirs and, you know, on your death, because they don't have to go through the probate process. So generally, that's what I would go over with a younger family, is to see if they, you know, wanted to think about a revocable trust, or if they weren't that worried about probate. But at the very least, they definitely should have a will to have a guardian for their children.
Okay.
So, Dan, do you have a will that has a guardian for your kids?
I do. So I was going to ask you a question, and this is not not for me. I have relationships with my family, which I'm so blessed about. So If someone has a will and they name a guardian, let's just call it their sister, for their children, and then, you know, 2 years goes by and then the relationship gets soured, and now they don't want their sister to be involved anymore. Or maybe they move across the country or something. What do we do as far as can we switch that?
Yes, absolutely you can. So you can, you know, change the will at any time. You could come back in to see us, and we could change the guardian in your will, you know, without changing the rest of the will. And that's why we say that your estate planning is, you know, ongoing, and you should always review your documents every couple of years, or when something big changes like that. So if your sister moved away or you're not getting along with her anymore, that would be a time to, like, pull out your documents and look at them and say, oh, is she named in any of my documents, and do I need to change them? So estate planning is ongoing, and you can change your will at any time. So that's important to look that over.
Okay, good to know.
Just out of curiosity, who is the lucky person who is getting your 6 children, if you want to share that?
our sister-in-law, who is local.
You and your stay healthy all the time, right?
right. Yeah, as I mentioned, we do have a great relationship, and I've got, you know, between, my wife has 3 sisters, and between all of them, there's 16 kids. I make up large percentage, of course. when we all get together, there's, you know, certainly the volume level is quite high, but it is a lot of fun. Yeah, my oldest sister-in-law is the big winner, if God forbid something happens to us.
That's But luckily, she's local, and luckily you have great family who would help out and pitch in. So that's nice.
He has a lot of local family. I don't. I'm from Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell because I lost my accent when I went to school. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I can still fake it if anyone wants to hear it.
I grew up in Queens, so we could do dueling accents at some point.
Yeah, so, you know, certainly it's more, I mean, certainly can be to have local family, and it's harder to get together with that are further away, but.
Mm-hmm. Right. Sometimes we have clients who are, you know, delaying doing their will because they're not sure of who they want to be the guardian of their children. And, I mean, that's understandable, but on the other hand, if you don't do a will and, you know, then it's going to be up to the courts to decide who's going to be the guardian. So even if you're not entirely sure of your decision, it's really better to try and come up with someone and get it into your will so you have some, you know, control over that rather than leaving that up to the courts to decide.
Right.
And some people have friends, you know, you may not have close family members. It could be a close friend, you know, or it could be someone who lives across the country, you know, if they're the right person. So those are things to consider.
So two years ago, I don't think anyone ever heard of the word Zoom.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we have Zoom, you know, people often ask me for closings. If I have clients that are live out of state and they can't make it here for a closing, we talk about signing mm-hmm. options. One of the things that comes up is, well, can we do a virtual closing? Can you sign the stuff for me? Can you mm-hmm. fax it? So for real estate, we do still require what we call wet ink signatures. You mm-hmm. can't document a deed. For the contract, we can. So that can go mm-hmm. back and forth 1,000 times via email. But for wills and trusts, and how do you arrange for signatures for that if you're working with someone that's not local?
That's a great question because during COVID there was an exception that we could do a virtual signing. So that meant I can notarize or witness a will virtually over Zoom. But that was only a special rule during, you know, the COVID emergency, and then that ended. So now we're back to, we still need, as you call it, wet signatures. And so we either have to have people come in person or we have to mail it to them and they have to get it notarized and witnessed where they are. And we are. So it's a little, you know, actually there's a law out there that is trying to make virtual signings for estate planning permanent because it was so convenient during Zoom and it would be really nice to have that option. But we don't have that option right now.
And we are at the bottom of the hour. We're going to take our break right here. We'll be right back with the second half of the Herzog Law Firm's Estate Medicaid Planning Hour coming up right after this.
You've been listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. Join us every week to learn more about protecting the assets you've worked hard for, options available for Medicaid planning, and more. With offices located in Corporate Woods in Albany, West Harrison Street in Saratoga Springs, Executive Woods in Clifton Park, and Flatbush Road in Kingston, our attorneys are here to help you. If you'd like to schedule an appointment to speak with David, Jane Marie Harry, or Debbie, please call us during normal business hours, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. To contact us at our Albany office, call 518-465-7581. Our Saratoga Springs office at 518-581-8131. Our Clifton Park office at 518-952-4010. And our Kingston office at 845-338-6405. Let the Herzog Law Firm help you navigate a plan that works for you and your family. Now back to the Estate and Medicaid Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm.
Welcome back to the Herzog Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour. This is J. Marie Schaefer.
And this is Dan Glasser.
And we're two of the attorneys at the Herzog Law Firm. And this is the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour, where we answer any of your questions about wills, trusts, guardianship, Medicaid, and you can call in and ask your questions. Our call-in number is 518-476-5900. Did I get that right, Ben?
You absolutely did.
Perfect. And, please call in. We had a caller who had a call in because he didn't get his question in last week. So if you want to get your questions in, please give us a call. Before we get into any questions, we have webinars every week. We call them Webinar Wednesday. And this week on Webinar Wednesday, we have two seminars. We have one at 10 o'clock, which is the top 10 reasons to plan your estate. And that's always a fun one to do. And then at 2 o'clock, it's How Not to Pay for Services, Long-Term Care Solutions. And with that one, we have our geriatric care manager, Kim Hans, join us to talk about some of the, free and, nonprofit resources that there are in the community to help you as you age and what kind of services you can receive in the community. So that's a really great one to listen to also. These are both Zoom webinars, and you can register for them on our website at HerzogLaw.com, or you could call the office 465-7581 and ask to speak to Stacy, and she can send you the link for the Zoom webinar. So before the break, we were talking about houses and trusts, and I know you do a lot of our closings, Dan, about clients who are selling houses out of trust. So sometimes you have clients who are buying houses in trust also, right?
Yes. More often than not, it's the sale side for the trust, but I've had a few this year with the trust buying. Those are usually transactions where the buyer is not getting mortgage financing, because not many lenders will loan money to a trust.
That's right. That is one of the, if there aren't too many downsides to a trust, but that is one that it's difficult to get a loan in the trust to buy a house.
J. Marie, Dan, we have another caller. We have Bess from Albany.
Good morning, Bess.
Good morning, J. Marie. I have been listening, and the woman who received the check on the sale of her house that was a home in a trust and had to deposit it into a trust bank account, well, then what can one do with that money that is now in a trust bank account if it isn't deposited indeed into a personal account? What is that money available to use for?
That's a great question. So when the money goes into a trust bank account, there's a few things that you can do. First of all, the trust says that you can receive all of the income that the trust earns. So if you put that money, and maybe a bank account's not a good example because it's not going to earn a lot of interest, but if you invested those funds, you can receive the interest or the dividends that are earned by those funds.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
yeah, and that... Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, that interest, if it's from the sale of a house, it's not going to be small dollars, but so that interest or the money earned from investing that amount of money can be used to pay for long-term care services or other needs that an elderly parent might have.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you can take that income and you can use it for anything you want, yes. So you can use it for your living expenses. You could use it to pay for, home health aids or whatever you need to do.
But the principal has to stay in the trust bank account.
Yes. So the So the principal needs to stay in the trust bank account.
Okay.
That's what's protected.
Okay. And that would have its own checkbook and its own way of withdrawing monies from the interest earned. Yeah.
Right. So if you do want the money out of the trust, for example, the interest, your trustee has to withdraw that interest and then give it to the, you know, grantor of the trust. You know, you could, or you could set that up to happen automatically if your trustee doesn't want to have to do that every month. You know, that's kind of more typical of what people do. They set up an automatic withdrawal.
Okay.
Right.
Thank you. That answered my question. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye-bye. So I did want to add in there, though, that you don't have to think that that principal is not, is completely off limits to you, because if you do need the principal for not all of it, if you just need some of it for some expense that you can't meet, there's a way to do a partial revocation of trust. And New York law lets you do the partial revocation where you get the consent of the beneficiaries of the trust, which is generally going to be your children, right? And then you could agree to take out a certain amount of money from the trust. Now, maybe to pay the cost for assisted living or to buy a new car or something like that. So, you know, even though in general you're not going to touch the principal of the trust, there are ways where you could get to the principal if you needed to. So that's nice to have that option there.
So, question for you. So, let's say a couple just signed their respective wills in one of our four conveniently located offices, Kingston, Albany, Saratoga, or Clifton Park. And then they say, Jane Marie, thank you so much for your help. You've been great. Now, what do we do with this original? So where do people put original documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for the wills, you know, generally our law firm keeps the original documents. We have a will safe that we keep all the original wills in. And you get a copy. And then people want to know even, like, where do they keep the copies and should they give copies to their children? And, you know, that's always up to you. You don't have to give your children a copy of the will. They don't necessarily need to know ahead of time. You know, some people say no, they don't need to know, and they keep it in their house and they tell their children where to find it when they're gone, right? Or some people are like, okay, let's have everyone know about everything, and they want to give copies to all of their children, so everything's kind of ready or transparent up front. what we don't do is we don't suggest that you put anything in your safe deposit box. And that kind of used to be done more in the past. But with the safe deposit box, when you die, that is usually frozen, and you can't get into the safe deposit box. Unless you have someone, one of your kids joins on the box with you. And there's been several times where a box is frozen and there is a way to go to court and get an order to open the safe deposit box, which you can do, but that's something you generally want to try and avoid because there may be important things in the box that is going to now take a few weeks to get.
Jane Marie, Dan, we have another caller. We have David from Half Moon.
Good morning,
Dave. I just have a question about you talking about wills. That's what I was, hello?
Yes, hello.
I'm sorry, I think my phone's dying on me. We don't have a, we own a house, and we don't have a will or nothing. We're wondering if we should have that done. For the kids, we got two offspring.
Okay, yeah. And it's owned jointly with you and your wife?
Yeah, well, actually, the house is in her name. We're not married, but we've been together for 30 years.
Oh, it's in her name and you're not married. Ooh,
no,
you definitely need to have a will then, okay?
Yeah, well, I'm just, it's not that I'm going after or nothing. It's just I want to make sure the kids have something. And I didn't want, like, if she ever, God bless her, passed away, we want to make sure the house is left to the kids.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely going to be better to have a will. Would she want you to be able to live in the house if something happened to her?
Yeah, probably, yep.
Because the reason I ask is it's not an uncommon situation. And I have done many wills for clients who are not married, where they say that if your partner dies, then that you have the right to live in the house for the rest of your life, and then it gets passed to the children.
Okay.
So that's one way we can handle that. If we didn't do that, it would go directly to her kids. And, I'm not saying they would kick you out, right?
Yeah.
but it's better legally to have that all taken care of in the will, so there's no uncertainty there.
Yeah, and you guys do that, right? You set up wills? And
yes, we do. We set up wills, okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Take care.
Bye, Dave.
So it has me a little worried where the house is in one person's name and the other person is not on the deed. They're not going to have to live in the house. So the other thing we could do in a case like that is also to put it into a trust, which would not only take care of leaving the house or letting him have a use of the house after she passes away, but it's also going to protect it in case either one of them need to go in a nursing home. If she had to go, and it's even more important when you're not married, because when I think about it, in this case, if she had to go into a nursing home, because they're not married, the house would not be exempt. Normally, a house is exempt if your spouse is still living in the house at home. But when you're not married, you don't have that kind of exemption. So if she had to go into a nursing home, that would mean that the house would not be protected and that Medicaid could put a lien on it. So it's really important to kind of, take care of that and think about that so you can protect the house, not just for him and for the children.
Interesting.
Yeah. So if you have any questions, we've been getting some good questions, please give us a call at 518-476-5900. We'd be happy to take your questions. So,
if you are a little radio shy, you don't hear your question over the air, you can call our office, 518-465-7581.
Yes, that's right. You could set up a phone call or an appointment to ask us your questions, and we do have free consults, so we'd be happy to talk to you.
So I'm excited for Wednesday.
I get questions sometimes about what's a good age to do a trust. And as an example, this week I had clients come in, and I did trust for the mother and for the daughter at the same time. And the mom was about 90, and she was doing a trust for her property. And, and her daughter was, in her 60s, and she and her husband were doing a trust. And normally you would think of, the younger couple, that's kind of the right age to do it in your 60s. But even for the mom who was 90, who had never done any planning, the reason we still chose to do a trust for her is because right now there is no look back period for community Medicaid. And she's someone who definitely wants to stay at home. Well, most people want to stay at home, don't want to go to a nursing home. But she has enough family living around that it's likely she could stay at home with some help. So community Medicaid would be a great option for her. And so we did the trust, and right now there's no look back period. So if she needs any type of care in the next several months, she could apply for that right away. And she doesn't need any care right now. She's a really healthy 90-year-old. Starting next year, though, and we're not quite sure of the start date. It could be April 1st. It could more likely be July 1st. There's going to be a change in the community Medicaid laws, and there will be a 2.5-year look-back period for community Medicaid. So if she does need care, after next July, say, there could be a 2.5-year waiting period to fully protect that house. So even so, giving all those risks, the fact that she's still in very good health right now, it's better to try and start that penalty period running, right, in case she does need help in the future, we can protect her home. In her case, it's a home with many acres of land because it used to be a farm. So it's worth trying to preserve that. We have seen many healthy 90-year-olds in our practice with doing trusts. I don't know if you've seen as many doing real estate, Dan. Have you? Is it usually younger people?
It's usually younger. We've had a few, in the 70s and 80s. And I think it's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right?
They don't look like they're 70 or 80, and you know, I wonder what their secret is. Perhaps it's drinking a bunch of coffee.
That's right. We have to maybe start asking people. Maybe that is the secret sauce, right? It's the coffee.
Yeah, I'm always looking for tips to maintain my youthful glow. And
for those of you who can't see, well, you can't see Dan, right? Because we're on the radio. Dan looks like a baby.
Yeah,
he has a very youthful look, right, Dan?
I do get that a lot. Is, you know, I walk in because oftentimes, you know, you talk to clients for 2 months about a transaction, mm-hmm. and the first time you meet them is mm-hmm. at the closing table, and they're often surprised with mm-hmm. with how I look. I don't know what the mask does, if it makes me look older or younger or more suave. Yeah, but. And then it's funny, usually when the topic of kids comes up, mm-hmm. some clients will hit the floor, like, how do you have that many kids? Mm-hmm. You look like you're 25. I'm so thankful that I can, maintain that glow. And, you know, maybe when I am 80, I'll mm-hmm. look like, you know, I'll still look like coffee.
We have to find out what your secret is for looking so young, because Dan does look much younger than he is, and he does not look like he is a father of 6 children.
Listening to great music and trying to stay calm in stressful situations, which is very difficult to do. But mm-hmm. I think it's beneficial, especially in real estate transactions. There can be a lot of tension, but it's important to stay focused on the goal and solve the problem and mm-hmm. get the deal at the closing table. And I guess I can't say it's getting plenty of sleep. I don't know what plenty of sleep is. Whether 6 hours or 8 hours. I don't know, but I'll take it while I can.
Right. It's definitely a great thing to have. I mean, I don't know. I kind of had a problem when I was first practicing after law school that I looked so young that people didn't think I was a lawyer. So I don't know if you've run into that, but
I still do. People think that I'm green, which I didn't know what that was until just a few years ago. Like you're just starting out, you don't know what you're doing. And mm-hmm. I tell them, well, I've done thousands of closings, to be doing this for 16 years. And I started when I was 5.
That's right. My favorite story is when I was, getting sworn in as an attorney, I was, we got sworn in at the courthouse. I was walking to the courthouse, and some person who was passing by looked at me and my parents, and they said, "Oh, you're going to your high school graduation."
Nice.
No, I'm going to get sworn in as a lawyer. They're like, "Oh my gosh, you don't look that old." So,
Yeah, I think it's great.
I do think it's great to keep young.
Yeah.
So I've been clients this week. I've been clients for a long time. And she had just turned 80, which, again, I can't believe. And but she and her now husband, say about 10 years ago, so maybe when they were, or maybe more than that, when they were in their late 60s, got married. It was a second marriage for both of them. They had, both of their previous spouses had passed away, and they both have children from their prior marriage. But they were so wonderful and so great at planning that they have done, they did a prenup agreement together. Then they bought a condo together, and they had an agreement regarding the condo. They were very proactive in making sure that everything was taken care of. They wanted to make sure that, you know, each of their respective children would get their share of the assets that they had. Over time, though, they have, and that's why they were coming in to change some things. You know, in the beginning, they were really leaving nothing to each other. But over the years, they've, you know, accumulated some money jointly. So they wanted to make sure that, you know, goes to the survivor of the two of them. So it's nice, you know, seeing that kind of planning in advance, because sometimes when it's a second marriage, and we actually have a bad case like this where, you know, if the first spouse passes away, the second spouse can change things so that the children from the first marriage get nothing.
Ouch.
Right. And unfortunately, that happens all the time, and we don't like to see that happen. So if it's a second marriage or a third marriage, or it's not even a marriage, right, if you're just living together, it's really important to sit down and talk to your partner about how you would want the assets to be distributed. You know, who, you know, should it go, how much should go to the children, how much should go to your partner. And then once you kind of come up with a decision about that, is to go ahead and get that in writing. You know, do it in a will or do it in a trust. It's pretty common to do it in a trust so that it can't be changed later on. If you do it, that's another risk with a situation like that. Jointly, you can come up with a plan and put that into place. But after the first person is gone, the survivor could then change the plan, right? Intentionally or not intentionally. But, you know, they could meet someone else, and that person could convince them to leave everything to them. So we want to try and protect you as much as possible by maybe setting things up in a trust for you. And when you come to us, if you think it's a situation we haven't seen before, we've probably seen it before. And that goes back to how long that we've been doing this. So you've been doing this 16 years, Dan, you think?
Yeah.
I have been doing this 26 years.
Oh, you got me.
I got you. Well, I don't want to go, but I do. So, quite a long time. And over the years, you do see a lot of different situations, so you have that experience to know how to handle them.
Right. And that's true in real estate as well, is even after doing this for so many years, there's still something new or a new scenario that comes up or something that I learn. And it's important. And then, you know, like what I've come up with over the years is, you know, because we struggle with, you know, these contracts that we use have language that says the closing will be on or before, you know, a certain date, and it really doesn't mean that at all. What I tell clients now, and I think this is patent pending, is like, you know, think of it like a pregnancy due date. You know, no one really knows when the baby will arrive, just like no one really knows when the closing will be, but if everything does go according to plan, it's usually somewhere around that date. So this time of year especially is, you know, I've got some contracts that have that date for the closing as the week
after Christmas before New Year's, which is a challenge because a lot of times people go away scheduling with the bank, the attorney's title company can be challenging. So I just want to make clients aware of that ahead of time so that they can plan, you know, don't hire movers, you know, don't call your friends and family from California because it might not happen that day.
Don't invite them to your new house until you actually have had the closing, right?
Yeah, yeah. Don't hire contractors to work on the new house if you don't own it yet.
Right.
Don't quit your job if you're about to buy a house.
That's right. Well, yeah, one thing you have learned new things over the years, and that something that I have never seen in the Albany area is bidding wars on houses, right? Have you seen that happen?
That happened a lot over the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. People paying, you know, $50,000-$60,000 more than what the seller is asking. So yay if you're a seller.
Right.
You know, if you're a buyer, you're paying a little bit more than maybe you want to. Those numbers have started to drop. You know, I think in the spring we were seeing incredible bidding wars, and houses, they were on the market for an hour.
That's crazy. Well, thank you for spending the hour with us. And if you have any further real estate or estate planning questions, you can call our office or tune in next week. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Estate and Medicaid Planning Hour with the Herzog Law Firm. For more information on their services, please visit herzoglaw.com. If you'd like to speak with one of their attorneys, please contact the Albany office at 518-465-7581, the Saratoga office at 518-581-8131, or their Kingston office at 845-338-6405.